Hey everyone, this is John Toda with a special message. As you may have noticed, this is our 100th episode of Learning Life. We're very proud of reaching this milestone and excited to see how far the show has come and how much our audience has grown. We're lucky to have a list of amazing guests who graciously come on the show and share their best knowledge and experience along the way. And I'm grateful for all of our listeners who keep coming back each week to listen to these interviews and learn about the lives of some of these great entrepreneurs and experts that join us each week. We know there's lots of things to listen to out there, so thank you for taking time out of your schedules to spend it with us here at Learning Life. We'll continue to bring you cool, interesting, and valuable guests each week, and maybe even surprise you a little bit with some of the new things we've got in store for the coming year. Thank you for being here, and please let us know what you think by leaving us a rating and a happy 100 comment wherever you're listening to us. And to our team who produces these episodes and the entire Learning Life online experience, senior producer Alyssa Galagani, sound engineers Ethan Silver Wheeler and Devin Hoare, and lead web developer Greg Suskin, thank you all for the efforts week in and week out. Now back to the show and happy learning.
If you don't know where you hope to go, you will certainly not end up anywhere productive. So it's not really about being able to predict exactly where you think we are ending up. And in fact, I think the situation right now is so uncertain that no futurist should even try to do that.
Welcome to Learning Life, where top experts share their business knowledge and personal journeys each week.
And the thing that I've realized, from the CEO to the NFL football player to the janitor, we're our toughest critics and we're hardest on ourselves.
I wanted to bring education to the market. I wake up in the morning and I am constantly learning.
The only way to grab somebody's attention is with a story.
Happy learning.
And now your host, John Toda.
Welcome back to Learning Life with John Toda. My guest today is Tran Unheim. Tran is a futurist, entrepreneur, author, speaker, and former director of MIT's Startup Exchange. His latest books are Disruption Games, How to Thrive on Serial Failure, and Pandemic Aftermath, How Coronavirus Changes Global Society. We'll try to talk about both books a little bit today because these topics are so relevant to everything that's going on these days. Tran's also the co-founder and CEO of Yegi, a search engine providing collective intelligence for industry professionals. He's helped launch over 50 startups and accelerated some very successful companies. So I'm excited to have Tran with us today. Tran, welcome to Learning Life.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited.
So I always like to start with everybody on their background, just kind of how you got into your space and your expertise. And of course, you're a futurist, which a lot of our audience are probably not very familiar with. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today as an author and your role as the former director of MIT's Startup Exchange.
Well, let me say first of all that futurist is a new label that I put on myself that is slightly uncomfortable because nobody knows the future. And in my previous life as an academic, for instance, these titles are scorned upon because, you know, what does that even mean? But let me explain how I got there. I mean, basically, I have worked in almost every type of organization, from startup to NGO to think tank, government, large multinational corporation, and now started several small, startup companies. And I've also worked for business incubators, you know, that accelerates that kind of process. So I feel like with a passion for technology, but a background in kind of social science, and looking at where the world seems to be going right now, there really wasn't a choice for me. I'm an independent thinker, and joining up different strands of thought and reflecting on where the next decade is taking us is really the only thing I could do. And, you know, I guess it's capitalizing on what I'm best at and then minimizing what I'm not so good at. You know, I think I'm better at collecting thoughts that others have had than I am at diving extremely deep and, you know, staying in one field of academia. So I think my entire career has been, I always position myself at the edge of whatever organization I work for, and then I look outward and bring insight into that organization. And that's kind of how I'm approaching futurism as well.
And so tell us a little bit about how that kind of plays into it, because obviously looking at or predicting future trends, it's kind of an interesting topic right now because we're in this aftermath, and obviously you wrote a book on this topic, of a major pandemic that is essentially changing so much in our business world and our personal lives. What do you now, as a futurist, what do you kind of, what's the practice now? How do you look at that and how do you use that as a tool to help people?
So being a futurist these days is not about prediction. Of course, you are always asked to predict things and you try to balance that. And you know, if you are in a certain industry and, you know, people might want investment advice, there are lots of different things that where futurist perspectives are useful. But mostly we have all converged on this scenario method, which basically is you look at the kinds of forces and you have to have kind of frameworks and ideas about what drives the future. And then you project some things into possible futures. So in my book, I chart up 5 different scenarios. And I'm not saying in the book, scenario 1 is, you know, 20% more probable than scenario 2. But I am saying that within these 5 scenarios, you will find the future. And that's the way futurist perspectives work. It encourages you and is very persistent and conscious about charting things that could happen based on extrapolating trends that are happening right now.
Right, right. And so your practice is really kind of looking at, and in this case, particularly 5 possible scenarios, 5 different ways that the aftermath of a pandemic like this could unroll for all of us, but not to really essentially say that you're the expert who knows which one of these scenarios will happen. Now, do you feel that when you say you've got 5 possible scenarios that are outlined in the book, how certain are you that one of those 5 would be the ultimate? Not to say that you know which of the 5, but has your research really shown that those are kind of definitely those are one of the paths forward for us after all of this?
Well, that's the other way that futurists cheat, right? Because we're also not saying that it's going to be one of them. It's going to be a combination of the 5. So we leave that also open. So now you could sort of say, well, I have guaranteed myself on all ends, but it is still very specific. It gives you a couple of frameworks to think about. So what I'm encouraging people to do, whether you are an individual reading this book or, you know, you are a government that wants to do a serious scenario study of what the next decade is going to entail, you think about what you want, and then you look at the factors that are playing out. And you know, my scenarios here are actually charting kind of year by year the development over the next decade in 5 different kind of ways that things could go. The important thing is, as long as you know what you're trying to optimize for, then you know at least what your desired future is. And that is actually the point of most of these kinds of scenario-based thinking models. If you don't know where you hope to go, you will certainly not end up anywhere productive, right? So it's not really about being able to predict exactly where you think we are ending up. And in fact, I think the situation right now is so uncertain that no futurist should even try to do that. In fact, I think even projecting short-term trends right now is almost meaningless. So if you see these disease models that are getting a lot of play in the media, it's actually completely ridiculous. They are doing statistics on things that are emergent phenomenons, right? So they're actually projecting short-term into things that are actually more meaningfully changing and changing faster and with different variables than they have access to. So, it's an inexact science, but there's nothing more important right now, I think, in this than deciding what kind of future do we want to optimize for? And that the book is, you know, full of detail on.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating too, is that, it, like you said, it's essentially a framework and in a way, an exercise to get you thinking about the future that you would like to have, at least, you know, for yourself or your own business. And in your mind, and you talked a little bit about short-term, people thinking about this in short-term solutions. And obviously for all of us, you hear about, okay, you know, the recovery is going to start. We're going to get back to normal. It's going to be this summer, then it's going to be the fall, and then it's going to be longer. And you're talking about, even and when they're talking about other aspects of it, these short-term thinking, what do you think the length of this pandemic or the aftermath of it? Is it something that you see lasting through the fall, another year, longer than that?
So in the book, which I largely wrote in February and early March, I chart 1 decade ahead, so 10 years. And I think in the last few weeks, I think I realized that time frame is probably too short.
Wow.
So if anything, I have become more convinced that we are going to be living this for generations. Unless something extremely fortunate happens, you know, either it miraculously goes away, which has happened to pandemics, or we find a miraculous vaccine. But in all likelihood, this is with us for good in the sense that it's not really a new normal. It is just something that we are going to have to keep adjusting to. I talk about this principle of intermittency, right, which is kind of hard to grasp or get your head around, but essentially we're going to go in and out of these lockdowns and in and out of completely relaxing, which is super necessary. You can't live, you know, in a complete state of heightened alert, but you also cannot ignore it. So we're going to have to become much more sophisticated about knowing what is necessary in any given local context. I'm from Norway. Right now they have sort of canceled the pandemic over there. They have eradicated it last week. Nobody was in the ICU for corona. Think about that. But I'm trying to remind them that their neighboring country, Sweden, thousands of people have died and they have just sort of thought they closed the border. That border cannot be closed forever, right? So we don't live in that society where we can afford to ignore our neighbors either. Someone I spoke to this morning said it's a noble moment for humanity. And it's kind of a Buddhist way of thinking about this crisis, right? In every big crisis, there's great growth. And the way I want to relate that is to my other book, The Disruption Game book, which is about learning from failure. I mean, if there is a failure to learn from right now, it is how we collectively, as a global society, have handled this pandemic. And there's basically four moves I recommend in that Disruption Games book. You have to meaningfully get exposed to disruption, then you have to take some risk or at least simulate very seriously that risk. And then importantly, the third move, you have to persist until the point of failure. You cannot just give up. This is how science progresses. This is how most learning happens. I know you're, John, very passionate about learning. Learning is about persisting. And in most learning, you at some point fail. And the fourth move that I advocate for, whether it's a business that needs to pivot or it is a fifth grader that needs to learn something, the reflection and the recovery phase is super important, but you can't get there unless you have persisted until the point of failure. Once you're there, you have to own that failure and reflect deeply on what is happening, seeking counsel, taking the time it takes to recover, but then prepare your next move.
And so this is an interesting topic too, and I love to be able to talk about disruption games now too, because so your position, and you know, we could frame this around the response to the pandemic and the recovery and how that's rolled out. But even just for all of our listeners who are business owners, entrepreneurs out there who, you know, might be dealing with more challenges right now in their business than they normally are, your perspective is so much of persisting to the point of failure is when you hit, I would imagine, the most amount of innovation. That's when you take your business to another level. Is that a lot of what you talk about in disruption games?
Yeah. And, you know, Disruption Games was not written with corona in mind at all. It was a book I wrote based on my experience at MIT Startup Exchange, working with 1,000 startups, tech startups coming out of, you know, arguably one of the world's most advanced technology institutes. But the thing is, a lot of those startups, some of them struggled. But the point is, many of them found creative ways or found pivots that were striking. One very interesting one. This startup, the founder came to me and I thought, you know, he's going to talk about marketing or something. And then he's going to talk about you know, aerospace, because he came from the aerospace department. And then they discovered that their solution basically only had one client at the time, which was NASA, right? And now, you know, maybe Elon Musk would be a second client. But anyway, I kind of revealed the point already, but they basically changed their entire thing around and discovered their software could be used for programmatic marketing on the internet. And so a decision software that was essentially tailored to deciding how many safe ways are there to get to Mars suddenly became software implemented in internet marketing and ad placement. Now, I mean, that sounds completely crazy. But they would probably not have developed that software unless they have had persisted with that one client until basically their breaking point when they realized, fantastic software, but it cannot ever be profitable, or at least not very profitable. You could sell it to that one client and say goodbye.
And so in your experience, working with so many startups, and admittedly high-tech startups coming out of MIT, how often is that the case where a tech startup is going in one direction, they think they've developed core technology that's really brilliant or innovative in some way, but their market focus or their market fit is off, or the way they've looked at it, and then they need that little pivot in order to get to what they ultimately become as a successful business. Is that more often the rule, or is that the exception that they need that pivot in a lot of these tech startups?
I'm going to go almost as far as to say it's always that case. I haven't to date worked with a startup that hasn't had some sort of meaningful pivot. And it's not one time. You know, within the products, within tweaking which direction you're going to take it. In fact, this thing, you know, is a little endemic. It can also become a problem. In life science startups, this thing actually happens, is forced upon them sometimes by investors, which is a bad thing. But many times investors will say, hey, we like product number 3. Please focus everything on that. So then they do a forced pivot, which is not good. And later, you know, become less of an interesting company because somebody with the money said, you know, focus on this. But I think in almost every company I worked with, they at some point, well, it's also just normal, right? You listen to feedback. You cannot just make your product in isolation. You are making it for a market. So at some point you have to listen to that market. That does not mean, however, that the Steve Jobs approach can't work, where you develop an ingenious product, and at least some of those products will then find a market because you have built something nobody could see. So I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but everything does happen in connection with communicating with the market. Many MIT entrepreneurs start very differently. They sort of think they see a challenge that either they have or somebody around them has, and then they build a company and an advanced technology around it, but they don't always consider whether that is a profitable particular market niche. So they many times have to switch target client, but the technology is usually very well thought out and can be used.
Hey listeners, are you looking to create engaging learning that takes place anywhere on any device at any time? Look no further than eLearning Brothers, the leader in immersive e-learning solutions. What started out over a decade ago with amazing e-learning templates has now grown into a learning powerhouse that can help you with every aspect of your learning and development programs. Whether you need the tools to create and enhance your own learning programs, or a partner to develop custom content and deliver it through an engaging learner experience, they'll help you rock it all. Right now, virtual learning is critical to all of our growing businesses, and the team at eLearning Brothers is literally the best in the business. Check out eLearningBrothers.com today and see all the ways they can help you become an e-learning rock star. Now back to the show.
Yeah, and I think of so many of the greatest technology companies that we use the tools every day now. And when you go back and read the history of how they started, they were building something for one reason or for their own use, and then it just pivoted and evolved over time. So I totally get it. And I know in our business, we pivoted. I know 3 major pivots that we made in the business that were critical to, I don't know that we would have survived as a company after 15 plus years if we didn't do that. And now my question for you on the title, Disruption Games, why is that the title? I was looking at it and thinking, is it that you think of it as a game in some way, building a business and the innovation aspect and not focusing so much on the failure but overcoming that? Is that some of the background for the title?
It's a tricky thing with metaphors. I think it's probably a little misunderstood and maybe it wasn't the best metaphor. But if you read through the book, I'm using the Olympic Games as my metaphor. So it's not really a tabletop game I'm thinking about. I'm trying to make the comparison between doing innovative things and practicing for an Olympic game, being a participant or aiming to become a participant, contestant in the Olympics. So you go through all these rigorous training protocols. But to my point about getting exposed to the right kind of disruption, I'm thinking that's akin to when you train with a good trainer, you have an infinitely higher chance of succeeding. This is in every field of learning. So that's why people pay a lot of money to go to the best universities. You have to go to the highest level and you have to see it as a very, very difficult challenge. And you have to expose yourself to those people that have the biggest chance and have proven in the past that they have succeeded at a very high level in whatever field. We are going into a world where you have to learn from the best. Otherwise, you should just learn alone. You just cannot afford to start listening to, learning, reading subpar stuff. And that, I think, brings me to the last point. And I know we don't have a lot of time, but in my startup, Yegi, the big ambition, which admittedly is taking a little energy to get to, what we saw there was it's very hard to stay up to date on everything that's changing in our professional worlds. Technology is moving fast. Industries, are being born out of some of the new technologies. And you have to stay up to date on anything from AI to robotics to 3D printing, to new social movements and now pandemics. It's overwhelming. So what we try to build there is a platform where that became a lot easier. And it's not a search engine, because a search engine just outsources everything back to you. It just says, you probably know what you're looking for. Just give us the good search term and we'll find it for you. But that kind of outsources the problem back into you. And we think there's a happy medium where the system also has to be a repository of at least the categories or the kinds of people that you should be looking for, the top publications, sort of like an advanced evolving curriculum.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me too, because I think that a lot of things get thrown into that bucket of a search engine, and there's so many different styles of discovering content, discovering research, and learning about it. And it doesn't all fit into one perfect little box. I also know you have your PhD. I think you have your PhD in future work and artificial intelligence. And that's obviously kind of a big topic now for a lot of the people in the technology space. A lot of the jobs out there that our population is involved in today will be replaced to some extent by a machine. What is your perspective on that? How much of your thinking, I think that's some of the your future work, I think your next book that you're working on is kind of in this space. Where do you see the future of work? What's your outlook on that right now?
It's interesting. The future of work is actually something I worked on, and I wrote a book called Leadership from Below a long time ago, which basically summarized my findings from my PhD work, which was even longer ago. At that time, when I did my PhD, there was this notion. It was kind of the first internet heydays around 1999, 2000. I don't know if you can remember those days, but that was another time when at least a subspecies of our population, the Silicon Valley crowd and some policymakers even, were thinking that nomadic work is what they called it back then, was going to take off, which was this notion that we could sit in our homes or on our islands or on vacation and be equally connected just because we now had the internet and we had email. And so my PhD was on this, and the degree topic, I called it What the Net Can't Do. So I was then viewed as a little bit of a contrarian. And the interesting thing, I find myself now, so many years later, still a little bit as a contrarian. I do think, and in my new book, Future Tech, there is a scenario involving a lot of change. But on the other hand, this idea that either just technology intrinsically or COVID or the combination automatically is going to lead us to comfortably sitting in our homes, glued to the screen and still having leadership positions and, guiding creative work in all kinds of organizations, I just don't see it happening. And there are a lot of reasons why, because regulatory processes are not there. Legally, a lot of people can't do it. Service professions, are not fully automated yet. That's going to take much longer. And then it's not even clear that it's desirable. Well, what's not desirable is the commute. Nobody wants to commute for an hour each way every day. So that is unsustainable. But there are a lot of other things that I think everybody misses during a pandemic, right? We want to meet. And why would we want to take that away? So I think this notion that the future work is only going to be all about machines is, it's true, machines are going to be in many, many more processes, but they're going to have many different functions than we, I think, see today. And to some extent, it's up to us where we want to deploy these machines. Then I would hope that we deploy them smartly and that we automate the risky, annoying, repetitive, and also some of the thinking work that just, you know, where you need recombinatory skills and pattern recognition, things that humans aren't very good at. But what we cannot outsource is things that we are hopefully still for a few decades better at, you know, creativity and things like that. And definitely, whether we are good at it or not, being together is something essential about being human, and it's actually essential part of work.
It's really interesting you bring up that point too, because like you said, part of what makes us different than machines is our ability to collaborate together, to be creative. And a lot of that comes from being together in a workspace. And so it's interesting, right, that everybody thought, okay, well, the future work now is just going to jump to full remote, everybody essentially operating like independent individual machines and not having that personal contact as much as we've had in the past. But I think it's refreshing to hear your perspective on that, that in a lot of ways, that's kind of what makes us uniquely human. And it's what makes us different than the things that you could automate with machines and artificial intelligence in some way, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, artificial intelligence and automation in combination. So, you know, it's not just the software, it's the various kind of form factors. So whether you call it hardware or actually the design form factors are going to be very important in what kinds of things we're going to be able to innovate around for the future of work. I'm actually the most excited about augmented reality, which is a field has been moving very slowly, but I think, and I believe this is part of your field, right? Experience, the learning experience. I think now the use case is really important. Augmented reality, extended reality, this idea that we need to find ways to use sensors, all kinds of new types of technology. The interface may not even be the computer anymore, but there's a great need to find something where you can at least simulate, maybe not even simulate being there together, because I think that's a misguided thing in all kinds of applications where you try to simulate something you had in the past instead of doing something different. So I think the future of work is about using technology much more creatively, not to replace being together, but to complement being together with a much more advanced experience of co-working remotely that doesn't necessarily replace, but actually adds a different element.
Yeah, I think that's so intriguing to think about. I know I had an expert on earlier in the pandemic stages, and we were talking about what was happening in everybody's homes while we were, teaching our kids at home and getting adjusted to remote learning. And she said, the problem everyone's making is that they're trying to replicate what's going on in a classroom. And you'll never be able to do that. It's not possible at home. Instead, you should try to replicate the homeschooling model. And in a lot of ways, you're saying something similar at a more advanced level that, don't try to simulate what you got in collaboration, in real world collaboration in the office, but instead there might be something newer and very intriguing and maybe even better in some ways that you could do with augmented reality. So yeah, it's fascinating to think of it, and obviously I could talk to you, for hours about all of this. I think everything you talk about is really so intriguing to me. But for our listeners who are just getting a small sampling of your thinking and your writing, where can they find out more about you, your books? Obviously, you've got Disruption Games and Pandemic Aftermath, as well as a new book coming out next year. And of course, your podcast show, which I think is new and probably very exciting for people to listen to. Tell us how our listeners can find out more about you, where they should go.
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy. My name is hard, but if you link it up, my personal website has links to all of those. So that's just tronunheim.com. But the easier, perhaps, phrase to remember is Futurized. So my podcast is called Futurized.co, and everything is also linked up from there. Essentially, the podcast is available on every podcast player. The books are all on Amazon and a host of other places that I've all listed on my website. What I'm excited about is, you know, has to do with being very interactive and talking to a lot of people about the future. So Futurized is really where I'm going to host a lot of the discussions that I'm having, including with experts that are going into future books. So that's perhaps kind of the one single source that I would recommend if people are interested in the perspectives that I draw up. And it's not just about technology, as we've talked about. I'm super excited about social dynamics, which are so important in shaping change. So whether it's new social movements, or it is actually just discussing business models, which can make and break a business. But I've also worked in government, and I realized that regulatory changes can, and standardization, those two factors can make or break a business and the future as well. They are extremely important, I think, in the decade we are going into now, because without setting some ground rules, there is no knowing where science would have taken us or where technology would have taken us. We have to actually decide, what are we going to do when these possibilities become more than possibilities, right? When robots are starting to appear everywhere, we have to have some safety protocols. When AI becomes more advanced, which I don't think it's a massive problem this decade, but going into the next decade, those are going to start to become issues. And certainly 25, 30 years from now, they are going to be very real issues. And, you know, I spent some of my career in think tanks advising parliaments around Europe on technology. It's not an easy task. These things are complicated, even for professionals in very small niche fields, just to track your own field. Now, try to explain that to a policymaker who has not spent any time, neither in business nor in technology. And then on top of that, you know, that has to lead to some sort of meaningful policy, which is a field that is neither technology nor business. I mean, it's extremely complicated, and we cannot get this completely right. We just have to adjust along the way.
And I think what you mentioned too in just now is, you can't really, as you said earlier, you can't predict the future, but you can implement this mindset or these frameworks of looking at all the potential scenarios, things that could happen. And it'll be a combination of those things. And so learning and just absorbing as much of that as you can is part of the process, and it helps you with disruption. So definitely for all of our listeners, check out Tron's website. We'll have the link in the show notes, so you can click right through and go to Tron's website. Check out his books, the recent books, Disruption Games and Pandemic Aftermath, and definitely check out Futurized, the new podcast show. And how many episodes? I know you just recently launched this, so you've got a handful of episodes out there already now for people to listen to?
Yeah, we have 7 episodes and the trailer, but they're coming out, you know, 2 every week, so it should rapidly gather up.
Awesome, awesome. Well, congratulations on the launch of the podcast show. And for our listeners, wherever you're listening, check out Tron's show. You can get right to Futurize from wherever you're listening. It's on all the major channels. And if you liked what we talked about today, you can get a much deeper dive, obviously, with Tron and his own show. So check it out. Tron, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. It was really fascinating listening to all of your perspectives on what's going on.
Thanks, John. I loved it.
And for all of our listeners, as you know, we have a new episode coming out every week. So wherever you're listening, be sure to subscribe, leave us comments. We always love to hear from you. And until our next episode, happy learning.